These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
The 1960s saw an explosion of fears for the future. While dystopian stories had already been around for centuries, and there had been times in the past where it was fashionable for European elites to believe civilization was doomed, the idea that the future was not something to look forward to really got cemented in the public consciousness in the 60s. Today, we remember the era's media promoting a wide-eyed optimism, but we forget what didn't fit that narrative. By the mid-60s, the new wave of sci-fi writing was in full swing, a darker, more surreal, and more literary reaction against the light-hearted sci-fi novels of the first half of the 20th century. On TV, we like to think of the original series of Star Trek as the ultimate optimistic vision of the future, a very 60s interpretation of technological progress, but even the Star Trek universe predicted apocalyptic wars sweeping the world in the 1990s and most of the 21st century. Part of the original idea behind the show was that humanity couldn't have reached the future depicted in Star Trek without unthinkable catastrophes forcing us to be more cooperative, and to reassure people that humanity still had a bright future, eventually, after the unthinkable catastrophes that everyone believed were coming.
All these atomic bombs will be dropping around the place. And it will, one will get near the center, because it will sort of make a huge great big crater. And then the whole world will just melt. Some madman will get the atomic bomb and just blow the world into oblivion.
There's nothing you can do to stop it. The more people get bombs, the more... Well, somebody's going to use it one day.
Well, I think that it'll be so overpopulated that there'll be wars, all nuclear explosions and everything. It'll make the Earth, you know, too much radiation on it.
This is from one of my favorite videos on the internet, a 6-minute clip of teenage British boarding school students in 1966 talking about their predictions for the year 2000. They almost all believe that we'd all be dead by then. And it gives me hope for the future, because I'm sure that if you polled teenagers today, they'd likewise say that we're all doomed, and just like their parents or grandparents who might be in this video, they'd probably be wrong too. Both the hopes and the fears for the future in the middle of the 20th century were rooted in an idea that the world was changing faster than we could keep up with it. Whether technology, culture, and society really were changing more rapidly then than they are now is a huge and nearly unanswerable question, but I do think the changes that were happening were a lot more visible. Cars, air conditioning, TV, air travel, microwaves, space exploration, all of those things had become commonplace in living memory. Youth culture was becoming more rebellious and independent. Major cities were in decline as people with money fled for the suburbs, while at the same time the world population was growing faster than ever before. After dropping for decades, crime was on the rise in the West. The mouse utopia experiments, in which a National Institutes of Health researcher built a complex inhabited by thousands of mice in close quarters, not too different from human tenements, drew global attention when the results were published in 1962. The experiments created what was dubbed a behavioral sink in the mice, in which the normally peaceful rodents fought each other, neglected their babies as soon as they were born, and even evolved a social hierarchy a bit like a beehive or an ant colony, in which the highest-ranking mice didn't reproduce or engage with any of the other mice at all. People were terrified that this would happen to people, that human cities would become behavioral sinks as well, and the media added fuel to these fears. In 1964, bartender Kitty Genovese was murdered outside her New York apartment. Soon after, newspapers began to claim that 38 people witnessed the crime, but none of them did anything about it. This was totally inaccurate. It's not clear where the 38 number came from, but it might have been the number of people in the building at the time Genovese was stabbed outside, most of whom were not aware anything was happening. Nobody but Genovese and the perpetrator saw the crime taking place, though several people heard her screaming, most of which did call the police. Those who heard it and didn't call weren't aware of the situation, believing they were hearing a drunken brawl. Absolutely nobody was aware of what was going on and yet did nothing. Nonetheless, the story of Kitty Genovese, the woman who was stabbed as 38 uncaring bystanders looked on, became national news, growing exaggerated to the point that sci-fi author Harlan Ellison, writing about the incident years later, claimed a man in the apartment building had turned up his radio after realizing what was going on in order not to hear Genovese's screams. Probably completely an invention of Ellison's. For many people, reading the sensationalized coverage of Genovese's untimely death, the Genovese case proved what the Mouse Utopia experiments had predicted. City life brought out the worst in people. Throughout this decade, a Mexican anthropologist was becoming increasingly fascinated by these theories. Do humans become violent when they're in confined spaces with each other? If humans become violent, what will they fight over? And once such violence has begun, how do you stop it, bringing people back into civility and civilization? I know what you're thinking. Oh, God. He didn't actually try this, did he? He didn't attempt to create a real-life Lord of the Flies situation in order to prove his dim views about humanity, did he? He did. Welcome to the wild, wild story of the Akali Raft. Researching this story, I've become fascinated by how fictional this story seems. It's real. There's no doubt about it. And I don't mean that it's more outrageous than anything I've ever covered on this channel, because it's not. The Akali Raft experiment isn't stranger than fiction. It's not the most out there thing I've ever covered. It's fascinating not because you couldn't make it up, like, say, the life of Rube Waddell, but because you could make it up. It could be a novel by Barbara Kingsolver or maybe Jan Martel. Several times during the research on this episode, I felt like I was reading not from the Annals of Anthropology, but from the Man Booker Prize shortlist. Not a lot of real stories have such a clear beginning, middle, and end with rising and falling action. Not a lot have such a diverse and interesting cast of heroes or as obvious and punchable a villain, who is nonetheless somewhat relatable with his tragic backstory and hubristic goals. The story of the Akali Raft feels like it has symbolism in it, themes, metaphors, and almost reads like it says more about human nature than it was intended to prove. I'm your host, Tor Parsons, this is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. If the Akali Raft experiment was a novel, a lot of attention would be devoted to the symbolism of the anti-hero's name. The Mexican anthropologist who started the experiment was named Santiago Genovese, one letter off from Kitty Genovese's surname. And you can draw a line right from the case of Kitty Genovese, or at least the inaccurate media coverage of it, to Santiago Genovese's ideas. Genovese was born in Spain in 1923, but the Spanish Civil War in the 30s forced his family to flee to Mexico. Seeing violence break out across Spain when he was a teenager, after Spain had remained much more peaceful than the rest of Europe during World War I, shaped Genovese's life and understanding of the world. He studied to become an anthropologist in his new home of Mexico with the grandiose goal of understanding what predisposes people to commit violence and how it can be stopped. As fears about human social decline mounted in the 60s, Genovese began to have less and less faith in people's ability to cooperate in stressful situations. He'd been looking at the results of studies on violence in chimpanzees, which found that when a small group of chimps is isolated from larger groups, male chimps will fight each other, often to the death, over their right to mate with the female chimps in the group. Genovese speculated that if humans were confined for long stretches of time, the same would happen. As the 1970s dawned, two things happened to Genovese that led him to set up an experiment to test this. First, in 1969, he joined the Norwegian adventurer Thor Heyerdahl on what became known as the Ra Expedition, in which Heyerdahl built a ship out of papyrus using methods that would have been available to ancient Egyptians, and attempted to cross the Atlantic from Morocco to the Caribbean, intending to prove that there could have been historical contact between North African and Mesoamerican peoples. Heyerdahl was accompanied by a motley crew of sailors, ethnographers, and anthropologists from all over the world, including Genovese. The first Ra expedition almost succeeded, but the ship broke apart and began taking on water, about 100 miles from reaching the Caribbean, and the crew had to be rescued by a yacht. The following year, Heyerdahl tried again, with a new boat. Once again, built only according to ancient Egyptian specs, once again with Genovese on the crew. This expedition successfully reached Barbados, but only after having gotten lost at sea for several days along the way, necessitating a search party organized by the United Nations. Being isolated for weeks on the high seas, looking after a strange and rickety ship, gave Genovese an idea for how he would carry out his human aggression experiment. He believed the only thing standing between the crew of the Ra and a Lord of the Flies scenario was the "we're all in this together" mentality, brought by the Ra being a collaborative scientific expedition. If you put a bunch of people like this together in a situation where there wasn't a clear shared goal, he thought, there would be a lot more disagreement, and possibly violence. But this wasn't quite cemented until 1972, when Genovese had the luck, in his telling, to be on a plane that was hijacked. He was on a flight from Memphis, Tennessee to Miami, when a group of small-time American criminals, attempting to flee charges they were already wanted for, took control of the plane during a scheduled stop in Alabama and demanded $10 million and to fly the plane to Cuba. In an action movie-ready cat-and-mouse game, the plane jumped around the U.S. for a few hours, landing in Cleveland, Detroit, and Lexington, Kentucky, as the FBI scrambled to meet their demands. At one point, the hijackers threatened to fly the plane into the Oak Ridge nuclear reactor in Tennessee. After they landed nearby in Chattanooga and got $2.5 million from the FBI, the hijackers seemed to be satisfied and distributed it to the passengers, then carried out their real demand to fly to Cuba. Fidel Castro did not grant the hijackers the asylum they hoped for, and upon landing in Havana, the hijackers were arrested and the passengers' terrifying but lucrative 30-hour ordeal was over. Genovese, who was there all along, said it showed him how, in situations of crisis, people's true selves come out. There's a quote by Randall Monroe, the ex-KCD guy, that goes like this: "You don't use science to prove you are right. You use science to become right." Genovese, ostensibly a scientist, took this adage and wiped his butt with it. He was determined to prove that humans are inherently violent, combative, and driven by sex, God damn it, and he was not going to let himself be disproven. Somehow, he had grand designs of engineering his test subjects into an orgy of fighting and sexual frustration, then somehow taming them, quite how this would work was probably unclear even to him, and becoming acclaimed as the man who found the root of what makes people fight. He commissioned the construction of a 12-by-7-meter raft, which he dubbed the Akali, meaning house on the water in Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs. The Akali was designed to be an uncomfortable place that promoted disagreement. There was no privacy anywhere. The toilet was a metal cage hanging out over the sea, in full view of everyone on the raft. The roof of the cabin was too low to stand up under, and everyone slept next to each other, packed like sardines. Genovese planned a 100-day journey, drifting without sails on existing currents, from Las Palmas in the Canary Islands west of Morocco, all the way across the Atlantic to Mexico. There were to be no books, no musical instruments, no electronics but a CB radio, and nothing else that could possibly serve as entertainment. This, Genovés was sure, would produce the results he was looking for. By early 1973, Genovés had everything he needed, except for willing participants. This was always going to be the hardest part. He put ads in newspapers across the world asking for participants, 6 women and 4 men, in a study that would involve spending 100 days on a raft. He didn't say what the subjects were to be studied for, other than that the experiment would help develop a theory of world peace. Genovés didn't want to potentially stoke violence by suggesting he expected the rafters to get violent. Surprisingly, applications poured in from across the world. It turned out Genovés could pick whoever he wanted among the thousands of applicants. He could select for anything, and it turned out what he selected for were people who would make this as hard as possible. Like a trashy reality show, he only chose young people who he thought were physically attractive, so they would want to have sex with each other. He mostly chose people who were in committed romantic relationships, and or had children back on land, so they would feel shameful about having sex. And, as we'll get into in a second, he had even nastier reasons behind picking some of the participants. The 10 people selected as prospective rafters were an extraordinary bunch, a microcosm of humanity that brings to mind that thought experiment we all did in 8th grade, where you have a list of 20 people with extremely varying ages, ethnicities, religions, abilities, occupations, and life situations, and you need to pick 10 of them to save in a nuclear war bunker while the rest of them die. Is that something everyone does in 8th grade? Is that one of those universal traumatic memories, like reading The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas or The Lottery? Or is it just something my weird school did? Anyway, the 10 crew members, plus Genovés on the Akali, were... Number 1. Faye Seymour, a 23-year-old American mother of 2, a sort of a free spirit with a passion for science and exploration. She managed the raft's radio, the rafter's only source of communication with the outside world. 2. Maria Bjornstam, a 30-year-old Swede, the first woman in the world to be certified as a professional maritime captain, and the only person on board with significant sailing experience. The choice of a woman as captain was another part of Genovés' plan to create drama, as he believed that if he put women in all the positions of power, the men would feel emasculated and want to take over. 3. Servan Zanotti, a 32-year-old diver from France. She was there to do a study on ocean pollution, but this was really just to keep her busy and to demonstrate that she was a smart and talented woman who the men would be jealous of, as the main focus of the Akali raft expedition obviously wasn't about pollution. Number 4. Eisuke Yamaki, a 29-year-old Japanese photographer. His job was to document what was going on. I'm not sure Genovés really thought through Eisuke's role. He was supposed to be one of the test subjects who were planned to devolve into animalistic brawling, but he was also supposed to take videos and photos of everyone but Genovés, including himself, devolving into animalistic brawling. Number 5. Edna Jonas, age 32, a doctor from Czechoslovakia, living at the time in Israel. Santiago claimed he chose an Israeli woman as the doctor because he thought Israeli women were headstrong and independent. This wasn't the only decision he made based on stereotypes, but in Edna's case, there was some truth there. She said she participated because she loved adventure and she wanted to test her limits. Number 6. Bernardo Bongo, a 29-year-old Catholic priest from Angola. He was mainly there so that people would feel even more shameful about the sex that they would be having, as well as for Genovés to see if he would break his vow of chastity, in turn proving that the experiment led to people's morals falling apart. Number 7. José María Montero Pérez, age 34, a former anthropology student of Genovés, from Uruguay. Like most of the men on board, his jobs were menial: washing dishes, steering the boat under Maria's direction, and other things that were either unimportant to the overall experiment or subservient to someone else. Number 8. Rashida Manzani, a 23-year-old Algerian woman who helped with the pollution study. She was chosen mostly because Genovés hoped that there would be tension between her and Edna, as Rashida was a Muslim and Edna was Israeli. Charles Anthony, number 9, 37, an ethnically Greek man from the island of Cyprus, who worked with Faye Seymour on the raft's radio communications. Number 10. Mary Gidley, the 36-year-old wife of an Alaskan fisherman. She was quite familiar with life at sea, given that she lived on her husband's fishing boat most of the time, but she had little detailed knowledge of navigation. She's one of my favorites because her decision to join the Akali was an act of getting herself out of a bad situation and taking control of her life, fetching the bolt cutters, as Fiona Apple would say. She had been beaten and abused by her husband, and finally jumped off the fishing boat and swam to shore after he threatened to strangle her. After hearing about the Akali experiment, she decided to sign up in order to take her life in a new but familiar direction. Back on a boat, but this time independent and in charge of her life. Or so she thought. A point worth noting, she was white. Faye Seymour, the other American on the boat, was black. This, too, was by design. In order to maximize tension, Genovés wanted representatives of what he considered the worst ethnic struggles in the world. Arabs and Israelis, and black and white Americans. Once the participants had been chosen, they were subjected to a battery of psychiatric, mental, and physical tests, as well as questionnaires about their beliefs on sex and violence. Questions included, do you think you might get violent in isolation? Do you think anyone else might? If so, who? Do you want to have sex with anyone here? If so, who? Genovés genuinely thought they were going to go absolutely insane, and by this point he was beginning to think something along the lines of, oh God, what have I got myself into? He was worried he might join his test subjects when they inevitably lost their minds. Perhaps he should have worried about different things going wrong, as his own psychiatric tests revealed that he had, quote, authoritarian, intolerant, immature, and infantile tendencies. Just as the Akali set off from Las Palmas on its way to Mexico, Maria, the captain, received a call on the ship's radio from her boyfriend that would cast a pall over the entire rest of the voyage. He asked Maria if she really had read the contract she signed at the beginning of the experiment, and proceeded to describe its terrifying details, not inaccurately referring to it as a slave contract. The contract all the participants signed had said that Genovés was to have complete control over the minds and bodies of the test subjects, and his word was final. Maria's boyfriend questioned the scientific legitimacy of the experiment, and wanted her to turn the raft around and end the thing. He laid down an ultimatum for Maria. You can have the raft, or you can have me. Not both. Now, Maria had already been having some trouble with her boyfriend before the experiment. She chose the raft. If that's not literary as hell, I don't know what is. Every week, as they got further and further out into the open ocean, Genovés would subject the rafters to a strange, very pseudoscientific sounding Rorschach-like psychological test. He would have them draw a tree. Apparently, this was supposed to reveal things about their mental state. If they drew a strong trunk, things were stable. If it had branches going in many different directions, the test subject was angry. Now, apparently, this really is a thing, known as the Koch test or the Baum test. And amazingly, I managed to find a scientific paper suggesting that some of the elements of the tree drawing really do seem to correlate with particular mental illnesses. But I can't seem to find data suggesting it can be evidence of a changing mental state. It can be used to diagnose major depressive disorder and maybe elements of someone's personality, but comparing trees drawn by the same person over time doesn't seem to be a common thing. Genovés wasn't a psychologist. Several weeks into the voyage, the Akali caught a shark. The rank-and-file rafters were overjoyed, because finally they had something to break up monotony, and finally they had something to eat other than the ordinary fish they'd been catching, and Genovés was overjoyed too, for different reasons. He took the rafters' excitement as a confirmation of his hopes/fears of violence, writing in the journal that the butchery and serving of the shark was an example of crowd frenzy, in which people, quote, no longer act as individuals, but as part of a dangerous collective. To everyone else, it was clear this was confirmation bias. I mean, dude, it's a shark. They weren't even all that aggressive to the shark. They just cut pieces of it and ate it the same way they would with any other fish. But Genovés was all like, they killed a shark! It was a shark and they killed it! There was blood!
savage!
Genovese even hid the boat's axe, which had been used to butcher the shark, because he truly expected that if they killed a shark, each other couldn't be far behind. But he was wrong about this. Despite Genovese's best efforts, the 10 people who had been thrown together on the Akali were all getting along. In fact, there was a truly striking lack of tension. Racial, religious, ethnic, and linguistic barriers melted away. Before long, Genovese was the only one who was still treating his raft mates like strangers. Everyone was swapping stories like old friends, singing songs from their countries of origin, and generally having a good time, or as good as you can have it, on a raft the size of an 18-wheeler drifting across the Atlantic. All inhibitions about being around others were lost. You couldn't even have privacy when you used the bathroom, after all, so why bother, people thought. Clothes started coming off, purely because people were overheating under the blazing sun all day. Genovese got excited when people began walking around the boat naked, thinking they were going to start having sex, and then there would be relationship drama, and then there would be fear and hatred, and oh boy, people were going to start killing each other! But he was wrong. Again. Everyone was so bunched up together, nobody could have sex without everyone else knowing and witnessing it. I'm pretty sure that if the test subjects really had gotten as violent as Genovese expected, his jubilation at being right would have been pretty short-lived. But if you think this somewhat comical figure, way in over his head, is as bad as Genovese is gonna get, just you wait. Pretty soon, you're gonna want to kick him right in his middle ball. At one point, the Akali's rudder broke. Servan, as the only one on the boat with significant diving skills, was supposed to be the one to fix it, but Genovese said no, he was the one in charge, and he was not going to let a woman do it. His motive here is unclear. Maybe he was afraid that she was on her period, and that her menstrual blood would attract the omnipresent sharks. A fear that some of the women had already voiced when they swam outside the boat. But maybe he just wanted to assert his dominance over the women that he himself had put in important positions, because he was pissed that the men weren't rising up and fighting them, as he expected. So, Genovese himself suited up in Servan's scuba suit and went down to the rudder, where he nearly drowned because his beard meant the mask couldn't be fit on in a watertight way, and so it filled up with water. Eiske dutifully filmed Genovese flailing around in the waves. Genovese said he'd try again the next morning, but Servan recognized that he couldn't do it, and definitely wouldn't be able to handle being told that, so she secretly went down and fixed the rudder all by herself in the middle of the night. In the morning, when Genovese was raring for another go, word got around that the rudder had been fixed now. Genovese was apoplectic. Relations between Genovese and the test subjects just deteriorated from there. He was deeply angry at the lack of anger among his test subjects, and his experiments seemed to be showing that there wouldn't be conflict. So, he was gonna create conflict. Some scientist this guy was. So, Genovese called a meeting. He had an idea for how to stoke conflict. He was going to take the results of the questionnaires the rafters had completed at the beginning of the trip, which, remember, included questions like, who here would you have sex with if you had to, or who here would you kill if you had to, and present them to the rafters in a kind of, gotcha! What do you think about each other now, huh? Sort of way. He started by announcing that Edna had said she wanted to have sex with Jose Maria Perez, but Jose Maria said he thought Edna was, quote, the most annoying woman he had ever met. Now, Genovese wasn't wrong in assuming this might create conflict, and it did, just not between the rank-and-file rafters. Everyone's reaction was essentially, haha, we sure weren't friends back at the start. What does this asshole think he's trying to do, turning us against each other? So, Genovese got madder and madder. I like to picture him in this stage of the journey, whacking his head against a wall, screaming, fight already! Why won't you fight? Why are you all getting along? More to himself than his testificates. Genovese resorted to throwing things at the wall to see what would work. Sometimes literally. He tossed a bucket of water over Maria once. Everybody, of course, took Maria's side. And Maria warned him that he shouldn't exactly try to pick fights with the captain, considering that he had limited knowledge of sailing, and she could put the kibosh on the whole experiment if she wanted, like an exasperated mom dealing with a son's temper tantrum. Genovese then tried to exploit the intended, but non-existent in practice, racial tensions on board. He began calling Faye primitive and a criminal, and that she should have sex with Bernardo, the priest, because he was the only other black person on the boat. Everyone, regardless of race, sided with Faye. I told you you were gonna hate this guy. Genovese got to the point where he was making things up about the other rafters. He'd go up to one and say, "This person said this thing about you. Doesn't that make you mad? Don't you want to take some action, if you know what I mean?" The inevitable response would be, "I know this person didn't say that. The only person here any of us has bad blood with is Santiago Genovese." And so the people of the Akali united even further. They already had close ties simply by being pressed together in a stressful situation, but now they had a cartoonishly nasty villain to unite against. On the 84th day of the experiment, the raft entered the warm Caribbean, and people were in high spirits to once again see birds above them, indicating they weren't far from land. But things just kept getting worse for Mr. Santiago Genovese. He received a radio transmission from his employer, the National Autonomous University of Mexico, informing him that he had suffered the same fate as the girl who nearly shared his last name a decade before. He was becoming the subject of sensationalistic media coverage. The Akali had been given its enduring nickname, the Sex Raft, by the tabloid press, and outrageous articles were coming out all over the world on the violence and orgies allegedly going on aboard the raft. In turn, several of Genovese's colleagues at the National Autonomous University had signed a statement urging him to stop the experiment, saying it was bringing the university bad publicity. It was the worst thing possible to inflict on Genovese's already weakened psyche. Not only was the Akali not devolving into a den of vice like he hoped, the entire rest of the world believed it had, and was excoriating him for it. For him, it seemed like the experiment had failed in two mutually exclusive ways. Dejected, Genovese retreated to the back of the boat, sitting on the toilet, dangling over the sea. The experiment had fallen apart by staying together. As much as the test subjects had grown to hate him, they couldn't help feeling a bit sorry for this new side of Genovese that was not angry, just disappointed, predominantly in himself. He wrote in his journal, "Only one has shown any kind of aggression, and that is me, a man trying to control everyone else, including myself." But the experiment wasn't over. Things were about to heat up fast. On the Akali, the seas began to get choppier. The test subjects started getting worried. Genovese, of course, the absolute penis head that he was, became excited. This, he thought, was finally going to get the reaction he hoped. If a hurricane came bearing down on them, people would turn against each other. He was sure of it. Maria, who of all the rafters probably had the most strained relationship with Genovese, said the only solution was to terminate the experiment, putting into harbor, somewhere in the Caribbean, until the hurricane passed. Not sure if it's Caribbean or Caribbean, I think I've said them both in this episode. But Genovese said no. This wasn't possible. Contact with others after this long would contaminate the experiment, as if all the other things he'd done already didn't contaminate the experiment. "For the sake of science," he said, "we must continue, no matter what."
"But it's for science!"
Maria said that as the captain, she couldn't take that responsibility, to which Genovese responded by declaring himself captain. He began giving orders for keeping the raft safe, as best he could. Everyone locked themselves into the raft's tiny, low-ceilinged cabin as the sky grew darker. Eventually, the rain stopped and the sun came out again. They had just drifted through the outside of the hurricane, never passing under its more dangerous parts. But everyone was seething. Genovese had committed mutiny. Maria reminded everyone, one by one, that under the law of the sea, the penalty for mutiny is death. And at long last, Genovese's treasured violence arrived. Not in the random, everyone at everyone else's throats way he expected, but in the most organized, cooperative, thoroughly human way it could. And it was directly, exclusively, against him. As Genovese sat at his usual spot in the back of the boat, recording information on everything from the weather to when the rafters were on their periods, the rafters sat on top of the cabin and discussed killing him. Eisuke offered to do the deed himself, throwing Genovese overboard on the pretext of getting him to pose for a picture. Faye rejected this, saying this would make Eisuke the lone murderer, and nobody else wanted him to bear that burden. She suggested that each of them put a hand on the boat's single knife and plunge it into Genovese, Julius Caesar style, so that they would all be guilty. They would then all wrap him in a sheet and drop him overboard. Maria would retake control of the boat, sail it to their planned destination in Mexico, and tell reporters that Genovese, inexperienced with the sea as he was, suffered a tragic accident and fell overboard. They didn't go through with it. Years later, Eisuke said it was because the test subjects knew each other so well by this point they were able to talk it out. Once a few of them suggested murdering Genovese would be a bad idea, the rest of them came around soon enough. So, even the violence that almost did happen was not only totally unlike what Genovese had expected, it was also resolved without his intervention, entirely by communication. It was also prompted not by the test subjects being stir-crazy and isolated, but by Genovese being a complete and utter large intestine. But since Genovese wasn't dead, he was still the self-designated captain of the Akali. One morning, the rafters woke up to see a gigantic container ship bearing down on them. They panicked. Faye tried to establish radio contact with the ship, but couldn't, and it showed no signs of altering course. Santiago had no idea what to do, but Maria did. She lit a flare, waving it back and forth in the early morning fog, and as the massive ship drew closer and closer, it began to slow down. At the last second, it turned away from the Akali. Maria had saved them. From that point on, people completely stopped listening to Genovese. Maria was the captain once again. For the remaining days, there wasn't much contact between Genovese and the other rafters. The voyage was almost over, and Genovese's dreams had not just been dashed, his dreams had been doused in gasoline, set on fire, and thrown out of a plane at 30,000 feet above a volcano, mostly by his own douchebaggery, and he knew it. Genovese wasted away, growing visibly thinner. The rest of the rafters were split on whether he really was sick, or if it was a cry for attention, a sign of how sheerly they mistrusted him by this point, after everything he'd done. Freed from Genovese's tyranny, the test subject's spirits soared. They were lifelong friends by this point, having gone through unbelievable challenges together. There was even, finally, some sex on the sex raft. Not a lot, but they'd all seen each other naked by then. They were all close enough friends that there wouldn't be any jealousies, and how else would they pass the time? The main hang-up was having Santiago Genovese, a decade older and far more pissed off than anyone else on the boat, still hanging around. On August 22, 1973, after 101 days at sea, the Akali arrived in Cozumel, Mexico. The rafters had all been either looking forward to heading home to their families or starting a new chapter of their lives, but they also kind of wished they could spend more time together. The consensus on the voyage of the Akali among the rafters was that it had been a nice trip if it weren't for Genovese trying to make them mad. Faye, especially, described having a profound spiritual experience one night, sitting on the back of the raft looking up at the stars, realizing that she was on a boat traveling from Africa to the Americas, drifting along the exact same currents that the ships carrying her enslaved ancestors had used, centuries in the past. In that moment, she felt more in touch with her identity as a Black American than she ever had before. She thought of herself communicating with her ancestors, telling them about her life, here in the same places where they had been taken in chains, now traveling of her own volition as a free Black woman. Genovese, of course, saw the experiment as a failure, and given that he interfered with the procedure in nearly every possible way to produce his hoped-for results, it's hard not to agree. This is what Randall Monroe would call BS, bad science. But I wouldn't be so sure. Genovese was doing everything he possibly could to turn the rafters against each other, and even in the face of that much stress, they stuck together. Nobody lashed out at anyone else except for Genovese. There's a genuine scientific discovery here. In fact, you could say he really did find a solution for violence. Communication. If Genovese had done everything the same, but gone into the experiment with an open mind, unsure of what his results would be, it's quite likely he would have come out announcing to the world that humans are naturally cooperative in stressful situations. It doesn't mean that humans are inherently peaceful, because there really was a point on the Akali where it seemed like things were about to get violent. But the Akali perfectly illustrates how, unlike the animal world, in which life is nasty, brutish, and short, when humans commit violence, we do it the same way we do everything. Together. That's what makes humans so amazing, I think. That's it. Not our brains, or our thumbs, or our ability to eat anything and live anywhere. We are social animals. We can form bonds with anyone, under any circumstances. And our default response to adversity is to find someone to collectively face it with. It's why we have war and why we have peace. It's why, at home in Algeria and Israel, Rashida and Edna may have seen each other as Arab and Israeli, but on the Akali, they threw away their differences and united against Santiago Genovese. There's an idea I really like by the blogger Tim Urban that goes like this. Your brain has three tiers. In the center is your frog brain. That's your most basic instinct. If you've never seen a picture of a frog's brain, it doesn't look anything like a human brain. It's pretty much just what we'd call a brainstem, because a frog isn't a very complicated organism. Then around that is your monkey brain. A monkey brain looks a fair amount like a human brain. That's the majority of the 3 pounds of wet mass inside your skull. You can use your monkey brain to reason, learn, communicate, count, all the same things that plenty of other smart animals can do. But then there's your human brain. And that's not a physical object. That's the sum total of all the knowledge humanity has gained, all the technology we've built, all the books we've written, all the memories we've experienced and shared with others. One human, on their own, isn't all that impressive. But you rarely encounter one human on their own. And that is impressive. What Santiago Genovese found on the Akali is that humans do not have an inherent tendency toward violence. But we do have an inherent tendency toward forming a community. What we do with that community is up to us. And while Genovese publicly declined to take any lessons from the Akali catastrophe, other than, I designed this experiment poorly and the next time I'll get it right and everyone's gonna kill each other, it's possible that he secretly took the real lessons of the experiment to heart. The next time Genovese showed up in the media was 1986, when he returned to his birth country of Spain for the first time in decades, since the civil war that forced Genovese's family to flee, after the country's long-standing far-right dictatorship had fallen, and full democracy had come to Spain for the first time, or one of the first times, in its history. In 1986, under the auspices of the Spanish National Commission for UNESCO, Genovese co-authored what became known as the Seville Statement on Violence. Signed by dozens of other psychologists, sociologists, and biologists from across the world. A departure from Genovese's previous pessimistic views on humanity, it read, "It is scientifically inaccurate to say that we have inherited a tendency to make war from our animal ancestors. It is scientifically incorrect to say that war or any other violent behavior is genetically programmed into human nature. It is scientifically incorrect to say that in the course of human evolution, there has been a selection for aggressive behavior more than for other kinds of behavior. It is scientifically incorrect to say that humans have a violent brain. It is scientifically incorrect to say that war is caused by instinct or any single motivation. Just as wars begin in the minds of men, peace also begins in our minds. The same species who invented war is capable of inventing peace. The responsibility lies within each of us." And can we just appreciate just how much the Akali experiment sounds like it could have been a novel? Think about the themes, the symbolism. These curtains are not just blue. Faye had a realization that she was retracing the steps of her enslaved ancestors, while at the same time she had consciously chosen to sign many of her rights away to a white man who had moved from Europe to the Americas, who had very much of a slave master complex about his test subjects. I'm definitely not one of the science is racist and subjective types, but there is a lot to be said about the hubris of science in this story. It reminds me a little of Hanya Yangihara's novel, The People in the Trees. Consider how Mary Gidley escaped being abused by her husband, only to be abused again at the hands of a man who claimed it was for science. When Edna came home, she was thrust out of this strange world peace experiment, in which she had notably become lifelong friends with a North African Arab woman, right into the thick of the October 1973 war between Israel and Egypt, in which she served as an army doctor. Every single person is so distinctive, they could and should be a literary character. Maybe truth isn't just stranger than fiction, it's more fictional than fiction. Today, Faye, Maria, Eisuke, Mary Gidley, Rashida, Edna, and Servan are still alive. They've met many times since they parted ways in Mexico in 1973. They still have inside jokes and a lifetime's worth of memories. They've been introduced to each other's families and form an international network of connections that few people have, even in today's globalized world. Ultimately, it seems that in the long and sordid tale of the sex raft, the real, violent, true nature of humanity is the friends we made along the way.